dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Venner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. A friend of mine recently told me she saw something on television that shocked her. It was some sort of event, a Republican Party faithful, during which the announcement was made that the city of Chicago had lost its bid to host the Olympics. The people at this event were celebrating this announcement because they saw it as a defeat for Barack Obama, who had been speaking on behalf of the city as an Olympic venue. Why this shocked me is not because it was petty. I'm no saint and have done my share of petty things. What surprised me so much about my friend's story was that the people at this event, who knew they were being broadcast, were not ashamed to display their pettiness to the world. People used to be embarrassed about such things, and it seemed to me telling that they weren't. This inspired me to present the material in this week's show. There will be two speeches. The first is a recent one by an investigative journalist who has been interviewed quite widely recently. He's Max Blumenthal, author of Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party. It was given September 24, 2009, at the Town Hall in Seattle. Unlike some of the other interviews that focus on the political party end of it, in this talk, when he's allowed to structure his own material, he focuses on sadomasochism as the dynamic underlying the politics. This got my attention because sadism seemed to me to be the salient feature of the Bush-Cheney political culture that we experienced for the past 8 years. From the kinky torture to Cheney's so-called hunting, which is not hunting. Many of you live in rural areas where hunting is common, so you know what hunting is. Hunting is not what Cheney and his friends do. They do killing. They go to these so-called ranches where caged animals are released right in front of them so they can shoot at them. It's the shooting without the hunting. On one of these trips, Cheney shot 400 pheasants. 400 pheasants. They want to portray themselves as macho men, but they are cowards who shoot fish in a barrel, so to speak, as opposed to real macho men who wrestle crocodiles with their bare hands. I'm not advocating crocodile wrestling, merely trying to draw a distinction. The second talk resonates with that theme, with a discussion of the political corporate culture as terrorism by atavistic violent male gangs. The speaker is John McMurtry, a now retired professor of philosophy from the University of Guelph. One doesn't get to hear him much, at least in this country. I originally aired this talk when it was recorded 8 years ago, when the show was only on two stations, so most of you have never heard it. The intervening years have imparted a deeper meaning to it rather than render it obsolete. So let's begin with Max Blumenthal.
We're here to talk about my book, Republic and Gomorrah, which is sort of just packaging of, you know, 6 years of research and reporting that I've done on the Christian right and the radical right, the movement that I can think controls the Republican Party. And most of the, you know, conventional histories of this movement begin with the Goldwater campaign in 64. But my history actually begins in the Armenian genocide, you know, in the oldest Christian country in the world, where the Rushduni family fled from the town of Van as the Turks moved in and massacred everyone. And a young boy named R.J. Rushduni was taken to California with his family, with his parents. He was the descendant of six generations of high priests in Armenia. And he viewed the Armenian genocide as proof that secular civilization was fallen and that man was doomed unless he could restore the kind of Calvinistic biblical society that his ancestors, you know, taught him about. So he started, after finishing theology school, writing these tracts, including this one 700-page book called The Institutes for Biblical Law, that provided a blueprint for replacing secular government, for replacing the United States Constitution with biblical law, which meant that the church would replace road building, all the functions of the federal government, schooling, healthcare, influencing the right with this libertarian strain, but at the same time a totalitarian influence, because Rushduni advised that the church, through Leviticus case law, replaced the criminal justice system so that disobedient children, blasphemers, adulterers, witches, abortion doctors would all be executed, perhaps by firing squad, which you could call the Christian right's trigger option. Rushduni's son-in-law, Gary North, who is an economics advisor to Ron Paul, the Republican presidential candidate, advised killing evildoers with stones because stones are cheaper. You know, he's an economist. And you know, Rushduni's very controversial. If you ask people within the Christian right if they've ever read him, they're going to deny it out of pocket. But he gave them the blueprint. I mean, he established the whole homeschooling movement and gave them the blueprint for the society they hoped to create, even if it was going to be in a diluted form and wasn't going to be the hardcore theocracy that he advised. But who gave the Christian right its tactics, moving from Armenia to another unlikely place? You know, I go to the Swiss Alps in the 1960s to a hippie commune where a Christian theologian named Francis Schaeffer was instructing, was holding these all-night lectures with, you know, the Jesus Freak movement. Kids from the United States would come there, you know, of all persuasions, including openly gay kids, and he would lecture them on John Cage, on Pablo Picasso, and how it all played into you know, Christianity and his view of the Bible. Timothy Leary visited him there, the LSD guru. Jimmy Page, the guitarist for Led Zeppelin, was seen with a copy of one of Schaeffer's books in his back pocket. Bono from U2 says Schaeffer is one of his favorite writers. But when the Roe v. Wade decision was handed down by the Supreme Court, Schaeffer was radicalized. He believed, for whatever reason, that the U.S. government had just legalized infanticide and would implement something along the lines of death panels. He actually said that, I mean, this is where it all comes from. And so he went to Washington, this really brilliant theologian who is becoming popular among, you know, the ranks of evangelical youth at Wheaton College in California and elsewhere. And he convinced the Republican leadership there, the moderate Republican leadership, Gerald Ford, he impressed upon them the importance of abortion, of opposing abortion. He also, you know, while he was dining with Gerald Ford at night, he was also meeting with people like Jerry Falwell, who had traditionally been obsessed with opposing racial integration. That was the only thing that could get Jerry Falwell fired up. You know, he denounced Martin Luther King in 1954, actually, for being political, and he called him a communist traitor. Paul Weyrich, you know, the Catholic right operative, went down to Virginia to meet with Jerry Falwell and said, I couldn't get him into this abortion thing. You know, all he wants to talk about is the blacks coming into his private Christian schools. But Schaefer told Falwell, the way that we're going to unravel secular society is through abortion and by using the tactics of Martin Luther King. But actually, by the end of his life in the early 80s, Schaefer was advocating domestic terrorism. He said we need to use force in the defensive posture, in other words, in the defense of fetuses, to stop abortion. He wound up spawning groups like Operation Rescue, which was responsible for the killing of Dr. Tiller most recently in Kansas, and at least indirectly responsible for dozens of murders of abortion doctors and attacks on abortion clinics in the 90s. And I'm friends with Schaefer's son, Frank Schaefer, and you know he's written some reviews of my book saying it was dead on. And he is sort of speaking from the grave for his father, because his father, at the end of his life while he was dying of cancer, wanted to denounce the Christian right. He saw them becoming power mad, and he hated their homophobia. He actually kicked Anita Bryant out of his hospital, away from his deathbed while he was dying, because she asked for his consent and support for her to pursue, you know, the anti-gay crusade in Florida. But it was too late. Schaefer died, and the Christian right moved into Washington with the Reagan Revolution, with Reagan declaring to Falwell and a group of ministers, "I know you can't endorse me, but I endorse you." All along, while Schaefer was lecturing, there was a silver-haired, bespectacled man with a sweater in the back of the auditorium. He was a child psychologist named James Dobson, who was watching Schaefer carefully. And he got to know Schaefer casually, and Schaefer despised him. But that didn't matter, because he wanted to continue this legacy. By now, I consider James Dobson, even though he's very old, the most powerful figure in the Christian right. He was probably most responsible of any movement leader for the reelection of George W. Bush in 2004 and for the really radical Republican Congress. But Dobson isn't a religious figure, even though he's leading a religious movement. He has no theological credentials. He has no theological training. He's a child psychologist. And the reason why I focus on him in my book is because I think, you know, besides his political power, more than anyone in the movement, he's cultivated the sensibility of the movement that controls the Republican Party. And you can look at his first book, which is a best-selling book, it sold millions, been reprinted several times, Dare to Discipline, as a document of this sensibility. What is Dare to Discipline? Well, it was left for my parents by an evangelical au pair after taking care of me for a year as a gift. My parents had reared me along the lines of Dr. Benjamin Spock, who is Dobson's arch enemy and also was, you know, attacked by the right. Spiro Agnew called him the father of permissiveness. And so what Dobson wanted to do through this child rearing manual, Dare to Discipline, was to roll back the 60s and in restore in children respect for authority and God. Actually, Dare to Discipline, still need that cup holder, is a manual for sadomasochism. Dobson says, the child should be spanked with sufficient magnitude to make him cry. Then you should welcome him. He will want to crumple to your breast, and you should welcome him with warm and loving arms. Now, what is that? Hitting and loving at the same time. It's sadomasochism. And I know that, you know, sounds funny, or I'm being extreme. But in selling millions of this book and financing this huge empire that he wanted to build, Dobson created a belt-wielding army of millions. He raised up the radical next generation of the Republican Party. Now, when I mentioned sadomasochism, I used that term. That term was originally discussed by a psychologist named Eric Fromm, who inspired a lot of the ideas behind my book. He says sadomasochism isn't just a sexual kink, even though some Republican figures like Ted Haggard and possibly David Vitter have participated in real sadomasochism. He defines it as a symbiosis of sadism and masochism. The sadism comes from the drive to beat down those who you perceive as weaker than you, minorities, homosexuals, foreigners, the poor, and at the same time to prostrate yourself before a higher force, a powerful leader, even a magic helper, someone like George W. Bush, who is a strong leader, someone like James Dobson, but who is the ultimate, you know, magic helper, who is the ultimate strong leader? It's the Jesus of Mel Gibson's Passion of the Christ, the ultimate sadomasochist. Mark Driscoll, local guy here, I don't know if anyone knows him, the hipster pastor. He took a nightclub and turned it into a church, and you know, this is a really burgeoning church. He says Jesus was not some Richard Simmons hippie queer Christ or a long-haired effeminate-looking dude. He was ultimate fighting Jesus, a terminator of machismo with calloused hands and big biceps. Another figure who's been really popular in the Christian right, who's inspired this bizarre model of Jesus Christ, who's anything but the Prince of Peace in the Bible, is John Eldridge, who is a former Focus on the Family counselor with Dobson. He fuses into Christianity a neo-pagan strain and says Jesus was actually William Wallace, the figure from Mel Gibson's Braveheart movie. I'm going to just read from my book since I have a little bit more time here and talk about John Eldridge. He's a reformed druggie who discovered Francis Schaeffer in his 20s and later went to work as a counselor for Focus on the Family. Eldridge wrote the men's movement's seminal tract, Wild at Heart. This book, which has sold over 2 million copies since it was published in 2002, called for men to model themselves after a hybrid of ultimate fighting Jesus and William Wallace, the virile Scottish separatist leader romanticized in Mel Gibson's movie Braveheart. Eldridge's Superman was the very antithesis of the Prince of Peace. He works with wood, commands the loyalty of dock workers, Eldridge wrote. He is the Lord of hosts, the captain of angel armies. And when Christ returns, he will be at the head of a dreadful company, mounted on a white horse, with a double-edged sword, his robe dipped in blood. Now that sounds a lot more like William Wallace than it does Mother Teresa. No question about it, there is something fierce in the heart of God. White supremacists around the globe shared Eldridge's reverence for Wallace. William Pierce, the deceased Idaho-based neo-Nazi leader known as the Farm Belt Führer, upheld Wallace as a model of personal sacrifice. That, I think, is one of the strongest things in our people and is something we need to call on and recognize, Pierce said. And for more people to be willing to do whatever is necessary, as William Wallace was. The Italian neo-fascist Umberto Bossi, who, while serving as reform minister to Silvio Berlusconi, proposed torpedoing boatloads of African migrant workers before they reached Italian shores, proudly adorned a wall of his office with a poster of Wallace. Meanwhile, back in Wallace's homeland, the Scottish Sunday Mail reported, hate-filled Nazis are using Braveheart fever to recruit Scots. They urge people who want to do something about the browning of our country to watch Mel Gibson's movie about Scots patriot William Wallace. And most recently, through my friend Dave Nyrert, who's here, who blogs at Orsinus and Crooks for Liars, I learned that La Familia, one of the top narco-terror gangs in Mexico, its leader is distributing copies of Wild at Heart to his followers, and he's using evangelical religion to galvanize his followers into this cult-like gang. Besides killing their enemies, as they did in Uruapan, Michoacan, when they chopped off the heads of five rival drug dealers and left them on the dance floor at a club, they go on morality crusades and attack and kill homosexuals. So the sensibility of the Christian right, Focus on the Family, by the way, broadcasts in Spanish, in Mexico, in countries all over the globe, and that's probably how Eldridge arrived there. But this sensibility is being globalized, this sadomasochistic sensibility. I want to go just give a little more Seattle history here. Ted Bundy is a local Seattle guy. He used to work. Sorry? Well, he seemed to be going somewhere for a while. And he was working actually at a rape crisis hotline in Seattle. And helped, he produced some booklets informing women how to avoid being raped or picked up by hitchhikers. Really interesting story. He was also a moderate Republican operative who had put on disguises when he worked for the campaign of former Washington State Governor Dan Evans. He'd wear a wig and mustache, and he'd go into rallies of his opponent, Albert Rossellini, with a camera This is 1972, before anyone thought of this. And he'd film Rossellini using different accents before different audiences. You know, he'd use a phony rural accent in front of a rural audience. And then they produced these commercials showing Rossellini as a, you know, phony limousine liberal. It was devastating. And Evans wound up winning. He made Bundy his personal driver, allowed him to babysit his kids, and Bundy became close friends with the assistant director of the state Republican Party. He was actually awarded Mr. Republican, I think, in 74. And he wound up using those same disguises to capture and kill possibly 130 women. While he was in jail, Bundy became captivated with the Meese Commission pornography report, which James Dobson and a panel, including some very interesting figures from the Christian right, produced this 1,000-page report, which included very explicit descriptions of pornographic movies that read like sort of just really clinical penthouse forum letters, recommended that the government ban vibrators and ban pornography, etc. Dobson became Bundy's hero, and Bundy planned one last publicity coup. This pathological liar gave Dobson his last interview before being executed and planned to tell Dobson, and did tell Dobson, that he became this pathological serial killer because he had seen Playboy magazine images as a kid. Actually, he was viciously abused as a child, and so many of the people who have wound up at Dobson's feet have been abused as a child, just as Dobson was. He brags in Dare to Discipline about how his mother would beat him with a girdle and yearns for a time when Farmer John could take his son out to the back 40 and set him straight. So this was probably, you know, what started it with Bundy. But Dobson took Bundy at his word and declared, after this exclusive interview, while all the rest of the press waited outside, that if Ted Bundy's going to hell, so are we. Then he promptly sold tapes of his interview to the media on the condition that they air them for an hour, unexpurgated, unedited, on national TV. And he sold tapes to his followers for one, making $1 million profit, vaulting himself onto the national stage and making a fortune. When controversy ensued, he donated all that money to, he said, charity nonprofits, which are actually anti-abortion groups affiliated with his political empire. This bizarre relationship with the serial killer and the saint in the Valley of Death is what vaulted Dobson onto the national stage. Soon, tapes of another video that Dobson produced called Where's Dad were circulating among congressional Republicans in the early 90s. And one of the guys who saw one of these tapes was Tom DeLay, who was known as Hot Tub Tommy when he was in Texas. He was, he's a lot like Two-Step Tommy, the kind of disco weirdo you saw on Dancing with the Stars. He lived in a place called Macho Manor with a bunch of bachelors, even though he was married, and he would have rowdy sex with women other than his wife. He was a drunk. And he was also going nowhere with his political career because he had no connection to the movement that was controlling the Republican Party. He was primarily just obsessed with stopping the ETA because he was the EPA because he was an exterminator. Through Dobson, Hot Tub Tommy transformed into the Hammer and wound up overthrowing Newt Gingrich, digging up information on Gingrich, and forcing Gingrich to resign after Gingrich pursued the impeachment of Bill Clinton while he was having an affair with a woman 20 years his junior who was on the congressional payroll after leaving his second wife on her hospital bed. And he had actually, when he married her, he had left his first wife while she was recovering from cancer surgery. So Gingrich was not exactly beloved by the Christian right. And DeLay was installed with Dennis Hastert as his puppet. And they produced the most corrupt Congress ever. So, you know, I talk about a lot of the corruption, a lot of the casino schemes that DeLay cooked up with Jack Abramoff and how they corralled all these Christian right leaders, including Dobson, into them. And so with DeLay facing money laundering charges in Texas and his popularity declining in his own district, at the time when it looked like he would even lose to a Democrat in Sugar Land, Texas, one of the most Republican districts in the country, he and Dobson throw themselves into the Terry Schiavo charade and try to save the life of this woman who is essentially brain dead. I had just moved to Washington at the time, and I went to a conference, a Christian Right conference that DeLay spoke at, where he said the judges need to be intimidated, because this was right after Terri Schiavo was taken off her feeding tube. A judge, a Florida circuit judge named George Greer, who was a Republican appointed by Bush, I think, had made the decision. And I was outside this conference with a guy named Michael Schwartz, who's the chief of staff to Senator Tom Coburn, the Republican from Oklahoma. And he said to me, you know, I'm a radical. He didn't know I was a reporter. He just thought I was a Republican because I look like this. I'm like just a white guy. And he said, he starts foaming at the mouth, and he said, I'm a radical. I'm a real extremist. I don't want to impeach judges, because everyone inside is talking about how to impeach judges. I want to impale them. You know, this is at the time when Judge George Greer was under police guard. And that night they had a ceremony, a banquet, and Terri Schiavo's lawyer comes up and says she was actually alive and she would speak to me. It was bizarre. And then at the end, some pastor asks everyone to get on the floor and pray for Terri. They called her Terri as if they knew her. And so I'm on the floor in a place just like this, and all these adults wearing suits and are on the floor and they're praying. And a pastor begins praying that Judge George Greer would be sent to hell so that his flesh be devoured by Satan. And I look to my left and I see the gigantic posterior of former Congressman William Dannemeyer, who had who had written a letter with 12 names of people who had died from non-natural causes at the hands of Bill Clinton when he was in Congress. And to my right, one of the few people not sit on the floor was Phyllis Schlafly, and her thighs were this close to me, you know. I could have bit them, you know. It's funny, but this is when I knew that the Republican Party had been captured by this movement, and it was going to implode very soon, because the mainstream America finally saw what the Christian right was about, how unconstitutional they were. And the press had been derelict in reporting on this, but finally they were reporting, because the Republican leadership was echoing, you know, the most hysterical cries from their base. And then suddenly, the perfect storm for the destruction of the Republican Party, bizarre scandals exploding into the open. The Party of Family Values is revealed as America's largest walk-in closet with Larry Craig, Ted Haggard, and Mark Foley. And, you know, we all know about those scandals, and we maybe know the details. But what I try to do in my book is to get behind the details and even beyond the hypocrisy argument that just because Ted Haggard was lobbying Bush to pass anti-gay legislation and then wound up in the arms of a studly male escort with a nose full of methamphetamines, that he was a hypocrite. There's more to it. I mean, there have been more scandals since my book has come out. Most recently, this low-level Michael Duval in California, the spank master, who is, you know, on a microphone, on an open committee microphone, talking about spanking a female lobbyist. All these scandals stem from the same pessimistic view of the self that the Christian right has, this Calvinistic idea. John Calvin said, he wrote once, he was looking at a baby in a crib, and he saw the baby seething with sin. It's the idea that the self is inherently dirty, and by doing what God supposedly wants them to do, the macho God of this William Wallace character, they can somehow transcend the self. Listen to Mark Sanford's press conference announcing his affair with his Latin lover, which he had on state money. He said, and the press never picked up on this, we follow God's law because it restrains the self from the self, and the self is the most selfish self of all. It was a bizarre statement, but I understood it to be exactly what I just said. John Ensign, the only Pentecostal in the Senate, far right-wing senator from Nevada, in this hand-scrawled letter that he wrote to his mistress, Cindy Hampton, who is a paid congressional staffer, which looked like a hold-up note written by a committee of Ted Kaczynski and Ted Haggard. He said, the reason why I had this affair with you and why we did this is because I walked away from God. In other words, he started relying on his self, his individual will. Mike Huckabee, on the campaign trail in 2007, this is in a campaign speech. He said, man does not have a God nature. Man has a sin nature. I go on and on with people who've said stuff like this, who are major Republican figures. But it illustrates that they're using politics and religion as a form of medication for their anxiety and what lurks inside the self. Because when they do what the self wants to do, when they do what they want to do, they tend to do some pretty freaky stuff, and they admit it. These scandals were at least partly responsible for the Republicans losing 6 Senate seats and over 30 seats in the House in 2006. And Karl Rove said as much. He said, you know, it's depressed the turnout from our base, the base that I built to bring Bush into the White House in 2004. So we move into the 2008 campaign with the Republican Party on the ropes, with the Republican brand extremely damaged by delays Congress and by Dobson's party. And, you know, out of nowhere, Mike Huckabee emerges. He's a close friend of Dobson. He had very little money in the campaign. He'd been written off. He's a close friend of Dobson. He says his favorite book is Francis Schaeffer's Christian Manifesto, where Schaeffer recommends force in the defensive posture. And he gives a speech in Iowa before some of the most politically active pastors in the state. And he says, my father was the most patriotic man I ever knew. He laid on the stripes and I saw stars. And the crowd rises to its feet and cheers. And those people go out and they work their asses off for Huckabee. And they send their congregations out to vote for him. And Huckabee defeats Mitt Romney, who is spending $8 million a day on advertisements in Iowa, handily. So what happened was Huckabee and Romney split the conservative base because Romney, who was overcompensating, wound up going for the Christian right as a Mormon, which couldn't work. And that cleared space for John McCain to emerge. The Republicans in the end decided to vote tactically because they thought that McCain would be the only one who could defeat either Hillary or Obama. But McCain was despised by the Christian right. Dobson went on his radio show and said, I cannot vote for John McCain, but we'll be watching. We'll be watching to see which vice president he picks. And, you know, behind the scenes, James Dobson was corresponding with this self-described hardcore prayer warrior and pro-lifer in the wilds of Alaska. And he sent her a letter commending her for having what he called that little Down syndrome baby and not aborting it, because it was a statement of her values. And he was at least, he was pretty influential in promoting Sarah Palin to the Republican grassroots. Because John McCain was despised by the movement that controls the party, Sarah Palin, as bizarre as she may seem to many of you, was the only logical choice for the Republican vice presidential candidate. And Dobson, as soon as Palin was picked, gave a full-throated endorsement to John McCain on his radio show and urged everyone to vote for him. And that was across the board in the Christian right. There was, at that point, they were confident about the Republican ticket. When I was in Alaska a year ago, and I'm going up on Saturday, I had gone up there to see a guy named Bishop Thomas Muthi speak. He is a self-described witch hunter from Kenya who claimed to have driven the witches out of his hometown of Kiambu, Kenya. And he was preaching at Sarah Palin's church of 20 years, the Wasilla Assembly of God. And I was just kind of screwing around on the internet the night before I was before he was going to speak, and I found a video of him anointing Sarah Palin in 2005 at her church with his laying hands on her, anointing her against the spirit of witchcraft. This was the kind of person they picked, and at that point I had questions about Sarah Palin. Perhaps, she'd been proving herself as a pretty effective attack dog against Obama. Maybe I shouldn't underestimate her. Maybe she wasn't, you know, Dan Quayle in a skirt. But after I saw this, it was pretty clear that she was going to, first of all, invigorate the base more than George W. Bush had and shatter the party. Her church believes in a theology called Third Wave, which is possibly more radical than, you know, what I talked about before, the dominionism of Rush Dooney. They believe that places and people can be possessed by demons and that those demons need to be purged out through ceremonies. Ted Haggard also believed in this and was seen in Colorado anointing intersections with a bottle of Crisco and a garden sprayer. I think this place would be sort of an epicenter of demonic possession right now. And beyond that, Palin was the archetype of the right-wing woman. I think she was mocked by the press because she was for abstinence, only education, but her daughter, 16-year-old daughter, was pregnant. But if you look at the facts on the ground in Palin country, you'll see why so many people, especially women, identified with her. For example, if you look in Lubbock, Texas, where abstinence-only education has been mandated since 1996, and Lubbock has this double the rate of gonorrhea infections among adolescent girls. Or if you look at a congressional survey called Ad Health, showing that evangelical adolescent girls lose their virginity at an earlier age than any other demographic except for black Protestants. Or if you look at a study by sociologists Peter Bierman and Hannah Bruckner showing that girls who participate in purity balls and lay white flowers at the feet of crosses, pledging to stay pure until marriage, are 50% of them are deflowered within 2 years. These are the facts on the ground in Palin country. It's why so many people identify with her in a way that transcends ideas, that transcends politics, and that transcends ideology and is so personal. And so when Palin came to town in, rural Pennsylvania, for example, which, you know, James Carville says there's Pittsburgh and Philadelphia and Alabama in between. People would come out and they would flock there, fill the rallies in much larger numbers than they would for John McCain, and they'd prostrate themselves at her naughty monkey heels because she was lifting them from the drudgery of their lives. She was a magic helper, someone providing them with what... symbols and a glorious cause that went far beyond the McCain campaign. When they said she had gone rogue, what she had done was she had made herself into a folk hero. And Obama became the target of the sadism that would give her followers and the Republican base this feeling of euphoria of kicking down the evildoer. And at the same time, you know, she helped them experience the masochistic part of the symbiosis I talked about before. They felt this sense of community, like they were together while the media was attacking them and mocking them. And so Palin went off script and called Obama a terrorist. She said, "He's not one of us." McCain never approved these attacks. And meanwhile, Obama was trying to be the great uniter, a community organizer. And he thought perhaps after the campaign was over, these people would come around and support health care. Maybe if he had Rick Warren speak at his inauguration, he could mollify them. No. There's a connection between the Palin rallies and the Glenn Beck rally at Safeco Field. It didn't stop with the campaign. It only intensified because they are totally out of power and they can only throw rocks at the institutions of power. They're back where they started, and in that respect, they're increasingly dangerous. And any hint of compromise eradicates the psychological motive that they have for this fervent activity. It destroys the sense of community they feel. It destroys the euphoria they get from kicking down evildoers. Newt Gingrich said it himself. He said, "I think you can write a psychological profile of me that says I found a way to immerse my insecurities in a cause large enough to justify whatever I wanted it to." And Newt Gingrich has seconded Sarah Palin's conspiracy theory that Barack Obama's health care plan contains a provision for death panels or Hitler's T4 program for euthanizing the mentally retarded and elderly. And this is what the party's become. The congressional Republican approval rating right now is 7% in the northeastern United States. It's 20% in the Midwest, and here and in other parts of the West, it's also 20%. But in the Deep South, it is 60%. It's the party of Joseph Wilson. It's the party of You Lie. It is a party that can no longer hold power on a national level. It's gone from Eisenhower's big tent party to Sarah Palin's one-ring circus. Now, while I was writing my book, I discovered a letter that, an obscure letter in the Eisenhower archives, that he had written to a military veteran from World War II who was dying of pancreatic cancer. the veteran had said, you know, we seek a leader who gives us, you know, statements of total security and assuredness. And you seem to be wavering and, you know, relying too much on nuance. It seemed like he was calling for a leader more like George W. Bush or Sarah Palin, an authoritarian, strong leader. And Eisenhower could have just tossed the letter away, but he decided to use this as an opportunity to expound on his vision of the open society. You know, and Eisenhower had learned about, had developed this vision while he was Supreme Commander of Allied Forces in Europe. He'd seen the rise of Hitler and Stalin, the two guys Obama's compared to now by Glenn Beck. He'd seen what happened in their societies, and especially in Germany, Hitler rose through a democratic process. And so he warned in his letter of those seeking relief of mental stress and the burden which democracy imposes, and those who seek refuge in extremist movements that offer them freedom from the necessity of informing themselves and making up their own minds concerning these tremendous, complex, and difficult questions. You know, at the time, he was under attack from the John Birch Society, the predecessor of these groups we saw on 9/12 on the National Mall. They accused him and most of his cabinet of being Soviet agents. They compared him to Stalin. Joseph McCarthy said the same thing about his Secretary of State. And Eisenhower wanted to guard his party against its right flank, against this incipient right-wing movement. But here we are, and we see a Republican Party that has ignored Eisenhower's warning and realized his worst fears. And with that, I'll take questions.
I just have a few quick reminders about Q&A. Please use the microphone since we are recording, and also please be concise so we can get to as many questions as possible.
Yeah, if you can make a statement, but just keep it short, you know, or make a statement without saying a word. But.
So I saw the values conference that went on in Washington, and somebody got up and said that pornography causes homosexuality. And I heard this, like, gasp from the crowd, like, no kidding. You know, I mean, where do they come up with this stuff?
You heard me mention earlier Michael Schwartz, who said, I want to impale judges. This is the chief of staff to the Republican senator from Oklahoma, Tom Coburn. He's the one who said that. He said, and he actually said, to stop children from using pornography, we should tell them it makes them gay and that'll work.
Mm-hmm.
Where they come up with it, I don't know, but I think they, in this instance, realize they've probably failed. I mean, I sort of sympathize with them on some level because if you have kids, you probably don't want them watching pornography, and there's no way to avoid it with the internet and with even MTV. And so they do manage to mobilize a lot of resentment against mainstream culture by attacking pornography. And the American Family Association, for example, advertises a pornography filter. They sell their own pornography filters. It's a big Christian right group in Mississippi, and it's their top fundraising tool, selling this porn filter. And they have commercials on Christian radio where they say, save your marriage with our porn filter. Stop web cheating. So like I said, with Sarah Palin and, you know, the facts on what I said were the facts on the ground in Palin country. I mean, pornography is a big problem in middle America. The state with the highest porn consumption rate is Utah. Oh, it's a two-front war.
My question is about the title of your book, particular the reference to Gomorrah. I remember the Robert Bork book that was attacking
right.
More of the secular. And so I was wondering why you chose to use that reference in the title.
Well, I looked at Republican Gomorrah and didn't turn into a pillar of salt. So maybe it wasn't Gomorrah after all. But it was originally going to be called Gomorrah, but then there was this book about the mafia that was really popular, and a movie, which was a pretty faithful adaptation of the book. So I just called it Republican Gomorrah, and it's really a reference to the sea of bizarre sex scandals and criminality that exploded out of the supposedly pro-family movement. And yeah, I definitely wanted to play with Robert Bork's book title. And by the way, since you brought up Robert Bork, my first involvement in politics was with Robert Bork. I was in a commercial narrated by Gregory Peck when I was 10 years old that People for the American Way produced against Robert Bork. And you can see it online. And I was attacked by the National Review at 10 years old. They said I looked like Beaver Cleaver. So, you know, over here.
Thanks for the explanation on Palin. I had no idea. But what's the connection with the industrial complex?
The military industrial?
Maybe the military, just all of industry that is now in support of the Republican Party.
Well, I mean, when we, for example, the,
like
the
how did it
well, Palin happen? Was actually just speaking at for a lot of industry titans in Hong Kong. And she blamed the government for the financial crisis and said the financial crisis stemmed from the liberalism and too much regulation. And that if we got the government out of everyone's life, then, you know, and the industry could run rampant, then everything would be just fine and dandy. I want her to run for president. I think a lot of you do because, like me, you love unintentional comedy. But more disturbingly, on 9/12, and you can go to my website, maxblumenthal.com, and see my video from the 9/12 rally on the National Mall. I was interviewing all these teabaggers, asking them about their health insurance, and a lot of them don't have health insurance, but they're rallying against having it. And the man who planned the rally was Dick Armey, the former Republican House Majority Leader, who's a corporate lobbyist for the healthcare industry. So you just see, it's corporations exploiting these very suggestible, resentful people who maybe aren't educated enough to realize who's manipulating them. But they do have, these people are useful tools for corporations. I think Tom Frank got it right in his book, What's the Matter with Kansas, about that.
Hello. I heard your interview with Terry Gross on NPR. Great interview. I was going to ask, you mentioned a character by the name of Lyndon LaRouche on there, if you could touch on that, and also if you've ever had any death threats or if you see any of this seeping into the Democratic Party. Sorry, I couldn't pick one of those. So on
See what seeping into the Democratic
Party? The same kind of doctrine seeping into, you know, Democrats in the, you know, Midwest or certain states that are trying to emulate, you know, blue dogs or whatnot. And then, and then the last one being if you've ever had death threats with, you know, all these things that you're uncovering and also obviously exposing.
I'll take the LaRouche question first, and maybe if I have time to answer the others. But I had written an article about how LaRouche and his cult were the first to compare Obama to Hitler. At a meeting of some board in Chicago where they were talking about how congressional funds would be allocated in the state of Illinois and elsewhere, one of LaRouche's top cadres, Anton Chaykin, who writes for his newsletter, somehow got a seat was able to ask a question of the panel, and Ezekiel Emanuel, the brother of the presidential chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, was on the panel. He's the chief bioethicist at NIH, and Chaykin accused Emanuel of having a Hitlerian agenda to write into Barack Obama's health care plan that Hitler's T4 program to euthanize the mentally retarded and elderly with very little basis. I mean, Emanuel's spoken out against euthanasia. But then we saw a few months later Sarah Palin on her Twitter account saying Barack Obama's health care plan has death panels in it that will possibly, and you know, if this health care plan is passed, people like her mentally, her disabled son Trigg would be killed. And Charles Grassley, the ranking Republican on the Senate Finance Committee in charge of negotiating Barack Obama's health care plan, seconded Palin and said his health care plan will pull the plug on grandma. But it really, maybe these people were unaware that LaRouche had introduced this first, but the fact is it started with LaRouche right after the campaign. And as far as death threats, I mean, I've gotten them, but I don't take them very seriously. I don't think I merit them. but anyway, it's better than having my birth certificate challenged.
You know, This the dialogue is getting extremely extreme. I mean, we can laugh about this, but I feel as though we're losing civility here, and that the fact that the president gets death threats and people are willing to out just bring their ignorance out in public and just show it to everybody, and it has a base. I mean, how far do you think this can go? I mean, in terms of will this lead to fist fights in the crowd?
Well, it did. I mean, there's a video that's really disturbing on a website that friends of mine run called One People's Project. And I should post the video on my site, but it's of these three young African-American vendors who are at the National Mall, and they wade into the Tea Party rally to sell flags. And they're suddenly attacked, not physically, but they're surrounded by people calling them acorn. Acorn! They're acorn! Because acorn has become Republican code for black. And it looks like they're going to be attacked physically, and they're terrified, and the Capitol Police show up and escort them out. But, I mean, Nancy Pelosi warned of the Democratic majority leader warns of political violence. I mean, whatever you think of Pelosi, it has to be taken seriously, and it's already happened. In Pittsburgh, a young 20-year-old neo-Nazi named Richard Poplawski, who had been posting Glenn Beck videos of Glenn Beck questioning whether Barack Obama had a plan to create concentration camps for Americans. He was posting these YouTube clips on his account on the neo-Nazi website stormfront.org. Poplawski holed himself up in his mother's house with some high-powered assault weapons, and when the Pittsburgh police SWAT team was called in, he gunned them down. His bullets, he had special bullets that could penetrate bulletproof vests, and he killed, I think, three cops. And when he killed himself, his friend was interviewed, his best friend, and he said he was against the government and he saw those cops as agents of the Obama agenda. I think Glenn Beck should be asked about this and should be held to account for the consequences of his rhetoric. So if the question is whether these things can happen, they already have happened.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello? Okay. Okay. Be really concise, hopefully, right? I have two points. It's very interesting. You're, like, tracing this intellectual history of, like, you know, the Christian fundamentalists and Reconstructionists, right? I mean, the far end, right? They would be Reconstructionists, not necessarily fundamentalists. But I'm wondering if you talk about this in your book, maybe I should buy it and read it, or maybe you can, like, touch on it tonight. It's the importance of this anti-intellectual tint in America that they seem to have hijacked. I don't know if you're familiar with, like, I mean, the development in the Christian right after the Scopes Monkey trial, I mean, that's a very pivotal moment in the fundamentalists. Like,
absolutely.
They felt embarrassed. They felt, I mean, you had Clarence Darrow and William Jennings Bryan fight out. And ever since then, up until, like, the 70s, you saw them in the shadows because of that huge, important battle. And they come back with a vengeance, with this anti-intellectual vengeance.
Yeah, and it took abortion to bring them back out of the pews after that humiliation. And they have this resentment of intellectualism, you know. I remember going to a big rally of Republican women. They call themselves Feminists for Life, but they're actually feminists against feminists, at the Republican convention, and Laura Ingraham was just mocking liberals. They think they're so smart, she said. They have so many. Laura Ingraham's a big right-wing radio host, by the way. And she went to Dartmouth, so I don't know how she's going to attack elites. And she said, these liberals think they're so smart. They think they have so many stamps on their passports, and people booed, you know, as if foreign travel is something so horrible. That's what they think. Know-nothingism is an essential component of the Republican Party today. And know-nothingism is, I think, best defined by the belief that if we rid ourselves of all foreign elements, we'll be living in a utopia. And if we rid ourselves of all intellectual elements, we'll be living in a middle-class utopia. You see it on Lou Dobbs. And Obama is a professor. You never forget that. They hate him also because he's an intellectual. And he has a foreign background. So he's sort of this multicolored piñata of everything they want to smash. There's a good book by Charles Peirce called Idiot America that takes this on, but I definitely talk about it in my book, about especially how Francis Schaeffer and his son Frank became estranged from the Christian right because of the anti-intellectualism, and because, as Frank Schaeffer said to me, they worship ignorance.
Thank you for taking my question. My name is Karen Cooper. I've recently retired from NARAL Pro-Choice Washington, and I really appreciate your comments on abortion. But I'd like you to expound, if you would, on other roles of women and the actual anti-woman approach from the entire religious right and the talks that they do about the biblical role of the family.
Right, right. You said you were with NARAL, right?
Just retired.
Oh, cool. Yeah. My mother came up with the NARAL slogan, "Whose choice, yours or theirs?" I think it was... She wrote it at my grandmother's kitchen table, I remember. But anyway, the Christian right, including Rick Warren, believes in women's submission, that women have to submit to their husband's will, and the husband has to demonstrate headship of the home. And in order, in return, women will receive protection from the man against the ravages of secular society. And unfortunately, that is, well, I won't say unfortunately, I'll just state the fact that that is very appealing to a lot of women. Mike Huckabee and his wife were remarried in a stadium ceremony in 2005, and they were given a covenant marriage. Covenant marriage was legalized first in Louisiana when Tony Perkins was a legislator there. He's now Dobson's chief lobbyist in Washington. And Huckabee and his wife stood, along with thousands of other couples in, you know, tuxedos and wedding dresses, and the wife verbally pledged her submission. All the wives verbally pledged their submission to their husband. The only way to break a covenant marriage is by demonstrating to a court 2 years of persistent drunkenness, or demonstrating, proving evidence of abuse. So when you enter into a covenant marriage, you have to actually prove that all of this is happening, instead of just stating it as a fact and saying, "I want out." Why two people would get into it, let alone women, is beyond me. And it's inspired by R.J. Rush Dooney's concept of biblical law, moving into the mainstream. You know, R.J. Rush Dooney's chief funder, his sugar daddy, Howard F. Amundson Jr., who's funding the Discovery Institute here in Seattle and funding the intelligent design movement, and who funded Prop 8 in California, declared in 1985, "My goal is the total integration of biblical law into our everyday lives." And with wifely submission and covenant marriage, we see it happening.
Do you think if an AIDS vaccine came about, do you think the Christian right would oppose it in the same way they opposed the HPV vaccine and Plan B?
That's a good question. I know that if technology to determine whether fetuses were gay or not came about, the Christian right would drop its opposition to abortion. But Rick Warren, on a serious note, to attempt to answer that, Rick Warren has been sort of credited with helping the Christian right move away from Jerry Falwell's belief that AIDS is God's plan for homosexuals, and that the AIDS is sort of a blessing because it helps them evangelize to homosexuals through this, you know, culture of personal crisis that I talk about. But there will always be extreme leaders who don't get the message. I think there will be factions of the Christian right that, you know, might not be so happy about that. But forget about, you know, hypothesizing. I mean, we're talking about, you mentioned the HPV vaccine. That vaccine would pretty much eliminate cervical cancer in women if young girls could get, if they could get it before they become sexually active. But the Christian right's fear was that it would encourage them to have sex, because then they didn't fear getting HPV, which is a pretty benign virus to begin with. So the Christian right is officially pro-cancer. And it's not funny, because women are dying of cervical cancer, and they don't have to be. And they actually have stopped the HPV vaccine from being distributed in some states.